All right, James Doohan.
Doing.
We'll get into all of that. In fact, yeah. There's something else I want to ask you about, too, in relation to that. Okay. Three, two, one. Hello and welcome to The Screening Room. I'm John Tibbetts, and my special guest tonight, well, we're going to be flying high. He's one of the members of the crew of the Starship Enterprise, James Doohan. And I've just been informed it is not Doohan, it is Doohan.
Doohan, as in how are you doing? Mm-hmm. Not even Doohan.
And I also get the impression that I could call you Jimmy instead of James. Could I get away with that?
That's true, laddie, and you could also call me Scotty if you felt like it, you know.
Is your ancestry...
Whatever slips out, you know.
Is your ancestry really Scotch?
A long time ago, but I'm mostly Irish and Canadian, you know.
And has it ever been satisfactorily explained to you how it is that so far into the future you would still retain the Scotch accent?
No, but I didn't bother to have that explained to me because I created the situation that in 300 years, everybody talked the same, you know, and practically the same language. And it was so boring that people went back to school to learn how to do, shall we say, Scottish accents, Russian accents, or even to speak Russian or to speak French or whatever, because the world was talking, shall we say, English. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a treacherous accent because it's one of those things that everybody thinks they can do, you know, but so few people can, I guess, really.
Well, yeah, I guess so. That's true. I've just been... blessed with the ability to hear every tiny little sound that people make, and it's not much fun for me if I don't do it perfectly.
I think the whole ethnic mix of the Starship crew has been one of the secrets of that enduring popularity. What do you think?
It must be so, because I don't think any other show ever tried it, and the very fact that they had a black person on and an Oriental, and then and they had a Scotsman on, you know, and with a sort of an accent, and then the second year they brought in a Russian, you know, he speaks with a Russian accent, and then everything else, and besides the green person, you know, with the ears and so on, and of course, you know, way back. When they were first going to do it, then the book came out with the affiliates. You know, they had the photographer brush the points off Leonard's ears.
Really?
Oh yes, because they thought the affiliates would not go for it. They don't.
I've
mind
never heard this.
They wouldn't mind being a little green, you know, or have green blood with a little green yellow tint to them. But they really figured that the affiliates would say no, we don't want that show. If they had a guy with pointed ears, so they actually brushed the points off for all the pictures. And then when they actually saw it on television, they were really quite shocked.
Hmm. How much of your life right now does Star Trek command? And how much of your life are you able to devote now to other things in addition to that?
Well, basically, Star Trek is, I would say, about 90% of my life. But I'm hoping pretty soon that it's... going to be, shall we say, 90% the other way, because I have a play that I'm very much interested in, and also I want to not only star in it, but produce it, and everything else, you know.
Is this one of those properties that found you, or did you find it, or did you write it?
Well, actually, no, I didn't write it. I'm not a writer, and I don't claim to be. Never have. I'm a good rewriter, though, because I had to do with that during live television days. But no, this there was another play that I complained about that I didn't get the rights to. It was called Billy Bishop Goes to War, and it's about the Canadian World War I our Royal Air Force ace and Royal Canadian Air Force. And he shot down, you know, like 60, 65 planes, something like that, and was, you know, a big ace. And during my younger days and his younger days, we looked alike. And I saw this play, and I really loved it. They wouldn't give me the rights to it. I mentioned that in an interview in some magazine, and this writer from Vancouver saw it, and his sister saw it also, and his sister said, well, why don't you write to Jimmy Doohan, send him your play, you know? And I love it.
Well, that's what happens when you have one of the most recognizable faces and presences in the world. And that's no exaggeration, I guess, is it?
Well, that's true. I mean, it's like so many people say that Star Trek is an institution, you know. And it really is. And, of course, you know very well that not everybody approaches you, but you can tell by the smiles that they and the nods they give as they walk by, you know, that...
You develop a kind of a peripheral vision, don't you? You can see it happening around you.
Of course, I have very good peripheral vision anyway, you know. I can tell when someone's cheating at the pool table.
Well, that's where the term canny Scotsman comes from.
That's true, yeah. Canny and can he really do it, you know?
You were talking about days back in live TV. Before we get into Star Trek, as I know we must, I really would like to know more about your career as an actor and in television before the days of Star Trek.
Well, Star Trek came on. Next January the 15th, I celebrate 40 years in show business. And the first 20 were completely without Star Trek. And the next 20 were, had Star Trek with them practically all the time. I did live television the very first week in New York, 1949. Martin Caine, Private Eye. I played with William Gargan, and he was a quite a big B movie star at the time.
You know what? I remember that show on television.
No,
I remember the theme song.
I didn't think you were that old, John.
That was really one of the trendsetters for that.
Do the theme again.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Holy smoke, you're the first person I've run across that even knows the series, much less it was in it.
No, I played a
detective, under him in that. And it was very exciting to do all those things. But, we would get, for a half-hour script, we'd get 90 pages. And, of course, we'd bring that down to about 27 pages, and this is where you became good at rewriting, because most of the writers at that time didn't know anything about writing character or really plot. They just had a good idea about what a show should be about. And we'd have the producer, director, producing the show on the telephone, and the actors would be sitting around a table like this rewriting the script.
And to know that it's all happening at the time. Deadlines are there. You're going to go on the air within hours sometimes, and it's still being rewritten. Exciting times, huh?
Yeah. Well, you know that the show that I did in 1954 in Toronto for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation is called Flight into Danger, which I brought with me here to Kansas City to show at the convention.
Kidding. All right.
Was the very first script that Arthur Haley ever wrote. It was live television, and the only reason I got the part was that I used to fly an airplane during the war, and the producer-director was wandering around, and somebody said, well, Jimmy Doohan, he flew, and so I was also, at that time, a sort of a character actor and leading man, too, and so I got that part. That part, NBC did it 3 months later. McDonald Carey played my part. Then about 3 or 4 years after that, it was made into a movie called Zero Hour. 10 years after that, it was made into another movie, or 12 years, 15, who knows, called Sky Terror, right? And I forget, Doug McClure, I think, was in it, that one. And lately, you have seen it, and some of the scenes, absolutely verbatim, Aeroplane.
Most people knew what they were doing when they went to the prototypes. Huh?
All right.
Where was all of this happening, in New York or in Los Angeles?
Well, that...
In 1954 now.
Oh, 19... No, that was Toronto.
Toronto.
Toronto, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And I had been in New York for, 7 or 8 years. And I went by back home one Christmas to see my mother. And on the way back to New York, I stopped off at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in Toronto, and I walked out of there with a year and a half's work. So, what are you going to do? Because actors need work, you know.
I'm kind of curious, what kind of a fellow were you in those days? How would you have described yourself to how would you have introduced yourself to a total stranger in 1954?
Oh, gracious. I don't know, but I remember a party I went to around that time, and a woman came to me and said, I know you're an actor, but what do you do for a living? Okay. You know. And I probably was making twice as much as her husband at that time. Yeah. I was busy. I mean, I was called. I mean, I had the nickname not only as the craziest pilot in the Canadian Air Force, but Canada's busiest actor. And I was working 7 days a week, anywhere from 10 to 14 hours a day, doing either radio or television or rehearsing for a play or something. Busy, busy, busy.
And amidst all those activities, what is a highlight or two that you could single out before the whole Star Trek period began?
Oh, gracious, I don't know. I was just busy, that's all. You know, mostly in the most famous thing I did at that time was Flight into Danger, because my wife was just reading the reviews of that play that were was sent to England, you know, the kinescope of it. And he was reading the reviews of that, you know, and it was like, my, why can't we get this kind of television over here?
All right, anyway, we were talking about some of those days. So you recall Flight to Danger as one of the big ones for you.
But, you know, there were just so many shows going on at that time I mean, the great people like Norman Jewison were, like, he was at that time and famous for doing the Canadian Hit Parade. He and another director named Stan Harris.
Norman Jewison did the Canadian Hit Parade.
You're darn right, and that's about all he did on Canadian TV.
You got to start someplace.
And then it came down to, yeah, but his creativity was, you know, it's a stock and trade for him. And he came down to the United States, and people were like, wow, you know, where'd they get him? And everything else. He did live Judy Garland shows.
And with Soldier's Story, he's maintained that kind of fierce integrity that's marked his career.
Well, he always has been able to do that. But, I mean, they did it on a budget of $20,000 a week. You know, that's not much money, you know.
Jimmy Doohan, how far back now can you trace that gleam in the eye of somebody when Star Trek first came to your attention? How far back do we go?
Well, we go back to the second pilot of Star Trek, we didn't have any idea of, you know, that it was going to be famous. It was just that an awful lot of people would, you know, would stop you and say, well, we saw your show last night, you know, and they didn't know what to say, really. But now they know what to say, you know. It's just gone, it was about 1971 or 72, that we began to understand the impact of Star Trek. And, of course, we thought probably, well, it'll be another couple of years, you know, and then that'll fade. But, of course, it didn't. It just kept on going and getting stronger and stronger.
How has your character as the chief engineer changed the most since the earliest days up to the films?
Oh, I don't really think he's changed at all because, you know, he hasn't changed any more than James Doohan has changed because I always tell people that James Doohan is 99%, or Scotty is 99% James Doohan and 1% accent. And I created him by opening my mouth, and because the rest was the 99% was there, and I opened my mouth, and he became a Scotsman.
Had this come to you by means of an agent, or was it something that you had checked out personally, the initial auditions and all of that casting?
No. About 2 weeks before they were going to do the second pilot.
And this is in what year now?
1965. March or April or sometime like that. I was called to read for a part of a Scotland Yard inspector on a show called Burke's Law with Gene Barry. I had the lead. And I didn't get
that. It was a spinoff of an old Dick Powell TV show.
Oh, was it?
Who killed Julie Greer, member of the four-star Playhouse, four-star theater?
Yeah, me.
Well, anyway, I'm digressing. Okay, go ahead. Burke's Law.
So I didn't get that part. John Williams got it. But about 10 days later, the director called me up and said, listen, I happen to be directing the second pilot of Star Trek, and I'd like you to come and do some of your accents for those people. So I said, well, who are they? said, I hadn't any idea about it, you know. So he told me, and I said, well, you know, what the heck, a job's a job. So I went down, they handed me a page of the script, and I proceeded to do six or seven different accents. And I do, today I do a sort of like a stand-up comic play on that, you know, when I'm up in front of a good audience. And
so are you,
no, I got the part. They said, which character do you like? You know, which accent do you like? And I said, well, I said, I think it's traditional. Scotsmen are great engineers, so I like the Scotsman. They said, well, we like that one too. Hmm. So that was...
So you had a hand in actually shaping the concept.
Oh, yeah. I created the character, and I named him. Also, I named him after my grandfather on my mother's side, because my middle name, I'm named after him. My middle name is Montgomery, and so I named him Montgomery Scott. So there we are.
Those days were filled with a lot of popular protest every time the show was under threat of being canceled and all of that. I guess at that point you must have begun the contacts with the fans that have continued up to the present.
Well, that's true. But Leonard particularly had tremendous contact with the fans, because around those days Leonard just had to change his telephone number about every 5 or 6 weeks, you know. But it all brushed off on us as time went by, you know. People began to see you, and they saw Leonard enough, and then they started seeing you and George and Uhura and people like that, and Bones. So it gradually wound up. Whereas once you are seen often enough on television, you become well known whether you want to or not, you know.
Meanwhile, it's fun to trace some of those extracurricular activities. Sulu, for example, is always involved in politics, and Uhura with the space administration, and on down the line. What are some of your activities that really claim a large part of your own time, be it a hobby or a profession?
Well, I like to go fishing a lot.
All right.
That way you relax, you know. I really like fishing. It's more fun. Even if I don't catch anything, it's nice being out there. I personally like being out in a canoe, mm-hmm. you know.
Take us
Northern Lake.
Take us on a little bit of a tour about your home life. Where are you generally? Are you close to some of that kind of territory?
Well, no, not really close to it. I have to travel to get to it, it's not that hard to travel and get out there. I live right in the center of the San Fernando Valley in Los Angeles, but I have spent just about every spare time I have fishing. Out in different lakes, mm-hmm. you know. And I did most of my first fishing up in northern Ontario. And, of course, they have thousands of lakes up there. You know, recently, coming back from Europe, I was able to sit in the jump seat of an L-1011. And we were flying over Quebec and Ontario. And, man, it's a garden of Eden for a seaplane up there. You know, there are just so many lakes.
Well, what about the flying? Are you able to keep that up then?
Well, a little bit, not much. I'm going to have to get back with it again, because I have privately have another company, and we just bought an airplane. So my wife's got to learn to fly it, and I've got to learn the communications and everything else. So. I'll be back into it again.
Meantime, shortly. The movies just keep coming. There will be a fourth. That's right. No
they're
secret by now.
No, they're working on number four now, but they're not doing too well, is that they've had two scripts, and it sounds like they're going to have the three scripts turned down, because they've had lots of time to do number three, and nobody said anything yet that they've got a script, mm-hmm. you know, so...
And at this point in time, however, are there restraints placed upon you about what you can talk about plot-wise, as to what scripts are in preparation and all of that?
No, the only constraints that are put on me, I put on myself, is that I don't bother to call Paramount to find out what's going on, you know? When they're ready, they call me, yeah. you know? And that's the way I like it.
Now, when they have called you for each of the movies, what kind of negotiations take place? Are you permitted some sort of a say in some of the scenes you will be in, some of the dialogue? I mean, it's so important to the fan that the crew have a chance to interact, to do the things that we...
No, we don't have my... We don't... We have very little input into it. But then again, the writers are smart enough to make sure that they don't put anything that is controversial that the actor is going to complain about it. You know, I mean, there's no reason to, because there's all sorts of things characters can do without being highly controversial, mm-hmm. As compared to the tradition of Star Trek.
The things that happen seem so right, though, when you're playing the pipes, Mr. Spock's mm-hmm. space funeral.
Yeah.
Obviously, somebody had a handle on that character. That's well, exactly that what should have happened.
Yeah, but that was happened. The writer, producer, and yeah. he called me up and said I was recently at a funeral, and he said and they played Amazing Grace on the pipes, you know. And I said, well, that's also as traditional, you know. And then when Jack Webb died, you know, a year or so after, the Los Angeles Police Pipe Band. They played Amazing Grace, and they didn't play it because it was on Star Trek. They played it because that's the tradition, you know.
And so we've just extended that tradition into outer space.
Absolutely, 300 years from now.
Yeah. What about extending things into outer space? What can you tell us now at this point about the fourth film? Has anything been decided?
I assume
Mr. Nimoy is directing.
Nimoy is going to direct, but the only thing I understand is that they hired a team of comedy writers. But those comedy writers have never sold anything before. So we'll see. I mean, they're maybe been given a chance, and I hope Paramount hasn't made another great executive mistake by the fact that these guys, they've turned down two scripts already that they've written, and it could be that all they'll do is just pay them and hire another person to write or another team to write. Paramount, I think, wants a comedy, and that would be great, as far as I'm concerned, to have a nice comedy. You know,
Where the name Eddie Murphy keeps coming up, I guess, in conjunction with that, huh?
Well, Eddie Murphy thing came up first, and then the fact that it was going to be a comedy came up second. But I think at least the scuttlebutt that I hear is that Eddie Murphy would love to be on Star Trek, but it's up to Paramount if Paramount can come up with a suitable script. And why not? When I heard the rumor about him first, I went to see Beverly Hills Cop a second time, you know. Sure. And as far as I'm concerned, it could work out, you know, because good writers can write for him. You know, why not? They've written for every other big star in the business, you know. And it's fine. It's fine with me.
My guest in the green room this evening, James Doohan, of course, Scotty of the Star Trek, Starship Enterprise crew of Star Trek. And I'm curious where you would like to see either your character or the other crew members' characters go in the future. What kinds of developments, changes? It must be such a part of you now that you begin to think of these characters as real people and. How are they going to grow and get older and all
of
that?
Well, I tell you what, the only way they're going to do that properly, as far as I'm concerned, is forget about sequels. We only got into sequels because of Leonard's situation. And we never did a sequel on TV. Why should we be doing it in motion pictures now? And you even have people saying, well, how are you going to get out of the court-martial, you know, and everything else. To heck with the court-martial. Forget about it.
Interesting.
You know, do a complete episode. And if we're going to have a comedy, you know, if they want to do a 1.5-minute movie to tell the fans what happened after the court-martial, right?
And then have done with it.
Yeah, and have done with it. Forget it. Mm-hmm. Right? Then let's go on do sequels. That's my idea. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Pretend that the third movie was the last one we ever do. Because then people are always talking about, well, what are you going to do? You don't have an Enterprise now.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Okay. That way you solve it.
Quick and sweet.
Yeah,
and you
absolutely.
Can get
right.
on with things.
You know,
what
yeah.
about...
Are you, are you paying attention, Paramount?
What about Scotty personally? Maybe some romance in his life, such as that? Any speculations or wish fantasies here?
Oh yeah, I have lots of Oh, you're talking about Scotty. Well, yeah, well, I don't know. Whatever they write is okay with me. You know, I'm interested in a play for modern day right now, you know. And the play is right down my alley, so it's just, I'm just delighted that it was sent to me.
Yeah, I want to get back to that in conclusion. I had one quick question first, which is that the general tenor of the films has changed since the first one, much to the betterment, according to many of the fans. How do you feel about that personally?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, I liked the first movie, but all they have to do to make it a good movie is cut out about 12 minutes of getting to V'ger. Then I like it, you know. And but I think the best one still is The Wrath of Khan, the second one, and mostly on account of Ricardo. He does such a gorgeous character, you know, and every time I see it, I just marvel at what a gorgeous actor mm-hmm, he is, mm-hmm. you know. And that's, to me, I love actors, you know. I mean, good actors.
But they see,
really, it's just fascinating for me to watch good actors.
And you're emphasizing the acting as opposed to the special effects, such a
oh,
prominent
absolutely.
Part of the first
Oh, yeah. The special effects, what the heck? That's like driving down the street. You have to have it. But good acting, that's something else, you know.
Now, when are we going to get a chance to see this play that you've been talking
oh,
about?
Oh, that's going to
Tell
be
Tell us again what yeah. it's called.
Well, it's called The Grand Finale. And it's about an old actor. That's all I'm going to tell until we start doing the publicity probably here in Kansas City when I take it on
right,
the road.
All
when
right.
I take it on the road.
Well, has it been okay. a while since you've taken on such a big project as far as the live stage goes?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, gosh, 10 years now since I did a stage play. And,
is it a little scary to contemplate?
No,
to?
No. No, listen, what good gracious, John.
This man is on warp drive now.
Yeah, right. I've been in the business coming up 40 years now, and if I don't, I have no fear at all, you know, but I've never produced anything. So, you know, it may be a little shaky there, but I intend to get very good help.
James Jimmy Doohan. Our guest in the green room tonight, I'm John Tibbetts. We're going to do this again next week with another very special guest, but in closing, I'm putting you on the spot. A little bit more of that accent, Jimmy?
Well, certainly, laddie. You know, whatever you want to do, I normally get paid for it when I do it, but so now you owe me about $500, you see. All right?
Or at least a few drinks.
Yeah. Oh, aye, that.
Thank you very much.